I was about to graduate law school, right? And I was desperate for a job. I sent out resumes everywhere, all over the country, but no luck. Not even a nibble. Finally, I knock on the door of one of my mentors. I'm in a straight panic. He looks at my resume and says, "What is wrong with you? Here's your problem here. This is way too black." "What do you mean too black?" "Let them find out you are black after they meet you, not now. You are trying to open doors, not close them."
"What?"
"Take this stuff. This is the Black Student Union, the NAACP, helping minority children. What is wrong with you?"
"But look, that's really what..."
"And how can you be in both a black arts and an Asian arts club? This is very dumb. But I really like..." "No, you do have the very unfortunate black name of Washington. Have you thought about maybe changing that name?"
"No!"
"Well, downplay it. At least do not stick this middle name, Darnell. You might as well be applying to Leavenworth." He keeps scribbling and editing. "There, send this." Well, I've got literally nothing to lose. I send my resume back out to the same firms that have already rejected me, and sure enough, just like my mentor says, I start getting interview requests. One from a superstar, Washington, D.C., pinstripe, button-down, top-shelf law firm. I almost faint. This could be my ticket to the big time. They fly me out to see them. The cab stops at the big fancy building. It screams establishment and money and golf. And sure, when the recruiter sees me, she looks all surprised. But it's too late. I'm here. Let the interviews begin. "You're scheduled to speak with 6 different attorneys. 45 minutes each." And I'm like, all right. Don't mess it up. My big chance. And I'm ready. And I get to the first one. He asked me, "Why would you like to work for this super elite law firm?" Well, blah, 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 blah. I'm spitting much nonsense. I'm playing the game the way the game's supposed to be played, and they're buying it. I know I'm getting high marks in the little review sheets. It's like 1 batter, 2 batter, 3 batter, 4, 5. Until I've got one last interview. The recruiter lady takes me to the final office, and this guy, he starts examining my resume. He looks up, and he says, "You know, you've got a real interesting background here." "Thanks." "Look, I'll write whatever you want me to write, but I gotta ask you, why do you want to do this?" And I start in with the blah, 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 but he stops me. Cold. Listen well. "This job, this one, it's gonna steal your soul. You might as well not get an apartment because you're gonna live right here, under a desk that looks just like this one. And these legal cases, I don't care about this crap. No one cares. It gives me a panic attack to think I'm missing my little girl because of this nonsense." And I'm hearing him, but I'm thinking, you know, that's all well and good, but cry me a river. I've got student loans to pay. So I smile and I nod about whatever he's talking about. And finally, the recruiter lady comes and gets me. She thanks me for coming by and tells me that I can expect an answer fairly quickly. The letter, it's waiting for me when I get home. I rip it open. I don't get the job. I can't believe it. I'm devastated, truly. I tell my mentor what happened. And he asked me, "Which firm did you apply to?" And when I tell him, he laughs. "Dumb person. You were never in the running in the first place."
today on Snap Judgment. From PRX to NPR, we proudly present Lost Cause. Amazing stories from real people spending their time tilting at windmills. My name is Glenn Washington. Please make yourself comfortable, but not too comfortable, because this is Snap Judgment. Now then, we're going to kick off today's Lost Cause episode with a story about family that is not a family story. As such, listeners with small children are advised.
I remember getting new hush puppies, and me and this kid named Henry, this little Chinese kid named Henry, decided that we thought it was maybe possible that we could dig to China. And so we dug a 4-foot hole, and I ruined my shoes, my brand new shoes, and got beat, you know, for it.
When Jay came home with mud on his new shoes, his dad was furious.
My mom interceded, tried to stop my dad from beating me. And I remember getting up at like 6 a.m. the next morning and scrubbing my shoes, trying to get them clean, and so proud of myself and like presenting them to my dad, like a cat presents a dead mouse, and like presenting them to him, like, look what I did for you.
One night, Jay was upstairs with his sister when he heard shouting downstairs.
It wasn't unusual for us to hear shouting and screaming and throwing things and breaking things. And this night was no different than many, many, many other nights. And I don't remember gunshots. The first thing that I remember is my dad shouting on the phone, "Some n- broke into our house and killed my wife." And just shouting that over and over again, "Some n****s broke into our house and killed my wife."
Jay's memory of the murder is just this: shouting, a phone call to the police, and a lot of blood in the kitchen.
And the first thing that I did was run to my sister, you know, screaming and crying, and I was trying to protect her. And I walked out to see if I could figure out what was going on, and she was laying there, and there was just blood everywhere. And he was shouting into the phone, and I was so terrified of him and the situation, I just ran back into my sister's room and didn't leave.
Jay later found out that his father had stolen a gun from the neighbor and then used it to shoot and kill his mother. His father was sent to prison, leaving Jay suddenly without any parents. At 8 years old, he was an orphan.
When you're 8 years old, you know something's missing, but you don't know what it is. You don't know how to, like, explain it. You don't know how to live with those feelings. You just, and then it just becomes your reality, and then that's just what it is.
Jay went to live with his grandparents. Like any 8-year-old dealing with that kind of loss, Jay started to act out.
And I would steal everything I could get my hands on. Watches, I definitely stole a watch and I got busted for it. And money, I would steal money and then hide it under rocks so that I could find it later. Be like, oh look, I found money on the ground, but it was really money that I planted there like 6 hours earlier. By fourth grade at the earliest, I had already begun to master the art of eliciting sympathy from anyone that I could get it from. Attention and sympathy, and manipulating people to feel bad about me, whether it's just to like get a cookie or like affection. I was a little manipulative monster. I was a bad kid.
The only adults Jay looked up to were his mom's two brothers, Uncle Brian and Uncle Lee. He was always trying to impress them, listening to the music they listened to, showing off when they would come over. His uncles were tough guys, not the kinds of role models most parents would want for their kids. But to Jay, they were nearly perfect.
Their biggest fault was that they weren't around enough.
There was Brian.
My uncle Brian is a pretty complicated figure. He was probably selling cocaine, definitely using a lot of cocaine.
And Uncle Lee, who went by Panhead because he drove a 1957 Harley Panhead motorcycle.
Long beard, Giants fan for life. Always wore a Giants hat with two braids coming down the front of his shirt, black t-shirt, kind of a belly, blue jeans, Red Wing boots, uniform.
Uncle Lee wasn't the type to step in, even when Jay started using drugs and got kicked out of college. He was a biker, and he had a troubled history of his own. But he was also Jay's uncle, the guy he looked up to most. So when Jay was in his mid-20s and started wanting to know more about what had happened all those years ago, he went to his Uncle Lee. And Lee had a story for him, one he'd never heard before. Lee said that one day, soon after Jay's mom was murdered, he was approached at a road stop in California with a proposition.
So these four tough outlaws start walking towards my Uncle Lee, and they're clearly coming to him. He knew that it was possible that his life was in jeopardy. He knew that, and they walked towards him, not making eye contact, kind of kicking the dirt a little bit, and said to him, "Hey, Panhead, we need to talk to you." They walked around the corner of the bar, and my uncle had a bottle of Jack Daniels in his hand, and he gripped it, ready for what was about to go down. And they just said, "We heard what happened to your sister, and we want you to know that we have guys on the inside that'll take care of your brother-in-law for a carton of cigarettes." My uncle's response to them was, "Hey, this is not a decision I can make on my own. I need to talk to my brother." And so they said, "Well, you just let us know."
Uncle Lee called up Uncle Brian. They agreed to meet at a diner called the Nut Tree.
And they're sitting across from each other, and, you know, Brian, without a doubt, feels responsible, like that he didn't do enough, and he feels this weight.
Jay found out a family rumor, and if it's true, it means his mother's life could have been saved.
My mom called my Uncle Brian, and when my dad left the house and said, "You need to come and pick up me and the kids, I think Jerry's going to kill me." And my Uncle Brian was drunk, and she had made that call before. And he was just like, "Put your shit together, Glenda. I'm not here to take care of you," and hung up on her.
Uncle Brian was devastated. He was taking the murder much harder than anyone else. And this was his chance. This was the closest he could come to avenging his sister's murder.
And they sat across from each other, and my Uncle Lee told my Uncle Brian what had happened and what the outlaw bikers had offered. And my Uncle Brian said, "Man, Lee, I don't think we're very good men, but I think we're better than that." And they decided that day not to have my dad killed. And I like that. I don't need to be a great man. I just want to be better than that. You know, I make a joke about that, like, so, you know, when people ask me, and it's usually women that I'm dating or their mothers, "How did you turn out so good?" The short answer is, two guys sat in a nut tree and decided not to kill a dude. Because it's easy to do things that feel right, you know, that feel right. The hard decisions are when you viscerally want to do something and you choose not to do it.
And after that conversation with his uncle, Jay did slowly start to pull it together. One decision at a time, not to be a good man, but to be a little bit better than the man he had been before. He even built a life he was proud of. Then one day, he got a call. his father, still in prison, had a lung disease that was going to kill him.
And he tells me that my dad's dying and that his wish is to see me and my sister before he dies. It was like just a slap across the face. I wasn't prepared for it. He's like too young. I thought that I had time to like be ready to be able to go talk to him and like find out his side of the story, and to be suddenly told that he had maybe 3 months to live.
Jay went back and forth about the decision to go. At this point, he hadn't seen his father in 30 years.
And I decided that the kind of person that I wanted to be was the kind of person that would grant a dying man his last wish, no matter what that man had done. That's the kind of man I want to be. So I decided to go. And we get to the infirmary. It's small and it's busted. Really busted. This really sweet, effeminate guy comes and leads me into my dad's room. And it's like paint peeling off the walls. And it smells just like old people and sadness. But there's this little radio that's taped to a rolling cart, like duct taped to this rolling cart that's in his room, and it's playing John Cougar Mellencamp's Scarecrow record over and over again, just on repeat. And I sat there with John Cougar and my dad. He looked defeated. He looked emaciated, and he was struggling breathing. His cheeks were caved in, and everything was a. I don't know if you've ever seen someone struggle to breathe like that. This is sort of like stuttered, belabored, like sort of, and it like would take him 5 seconds to like take a breath. And I'm supposed to be feeling all these things, and mostly I'm just annoyed. I'm just like, he's not even conscious. I'm like, so what do we do? I reached out and like just like touched him with my finger, like you're touching a snake or something that you're like, ooh, and then pulled back really quick.
And then, with his father lying there unconscious, Jay took his last chance to talk to his dad.
And telling him all those things of like, that of everything that he robbed me of.
What did he rob you of?
My mother, my childhood. He robbed me of even early adulthood. I said, you. You deserve this. You deserve to suffer. And you deserve to have your last breaths be the most painful thing that's ever happened to you. And I hate you. And I was gleeful almost about it. It was this gleeful anger. Like I felt so good watching him just barely be able to breathe. Yeah, I was shocked by my own anger. And not only my own anger. Like we all get angry and usually it feels kind of gross. And maybe it feels like a little bit of a relief because we get to like set something out. But I was getting off on it. Like, it felt good to feel hate towards him. And I was just about to leave, and he came to. And he just took a deep breath and said, I'm sorry. And then went unconscious again. And I sat there and I held his hand for about 5 minutes and then got up and left. And then he died 12 hours later.
If the kind of man you wanted to be was the kind of man that would grant a man his dying wish, The truth is you got there, and the kind of man you were in that moment was an angry man who yelled at the dying man on the bed.
I mean, those things can totally sit by side each other. Like, I think I can totally go and sit with him and, you know, say goodbye and be angry and let him know that I'm angry and still have done the right thing. That's the thing, right? I don't need to be a good man. I just want to be better than that.
Thank you, Jay, for sharing your story with The Snap. It was produced by Lena Masitsis and Julia DeWitt. Now, when Snap Judgment continues, we're running into an arena filled with thousands of cheering fans. And for once, we're going to be too smart for our own good. When Snap Judgment, the Lost Cause episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Lost Cause episode. Now today, even though something appears unwinnable, we are not saying no. For our next story, Snap Judgment's Nancy Lopez speaks to Marco Vidal. Now, because of the violence surrounding characters in this piece, listener discretion is advised.
Growing up in Dallas, Marco Vidal's one and only dream was to become a professional soccer player in Mexico. And when he turned 15, his dream almost came true. He was picked up by Los Tigres, or the Tigers, a team from northern Mexico. But just when he thought he'd be selected to debut in the major league, new coaches came in and they sent Marco packing.
I did not want to know anything about soccer anymore. I didn't go play anywhere. I didn't train anywhere. I didn't want to know anything about the sport. I didn't want it to remind me of how close I was to reach my goal, and things just didn't happen.
Marco was just a 20-year-old guy living back in Dallas with his parents. He tried to accept a life without soccer, the bright lights, the cheering fans. And so he got a job at a local radio station.
But it wasn't my life. I don't know. I could not forget about the sport. I could not forget about my career. I could not forget about me trying to reach my dream.
That was until one day, when he got a very unexpected call from a little-known soccer team in Mexico named Los Indios, or the Indians.
There was an open spot. They needed somebody in my position down there that if I wanted to go. A huge smile came into my face, and I remember things, the good things that had happened to me inside the sport.
The only problem was, Los Indios played in one of the deadliest places in the world, Ciudad Juárez, a desert city just a hop across the border from El Paso. Marco didn't know exactly how bad it would be to live there.
What I had Googled a little bit back in the day was when they used to kill a lot of women, a city not seen very good by the states.
Still, the potential danger wasn't worth sacrificing his dream.
I didn't want to live in regret. I didn't want to sit in my 30s or in my 40s and think, what if I would have gone? What if, and I decided to go down.
Marco packed his bags and crossed into Juarez. What he found was an unsightly, transient city, a border town full of maquiladoras or factories. And when he met Los Indios, he found a team with all the odds stacked up against it. They didn't have the best players. Most were young and inexperienced. They were rarely paid on time. In fact, Los Indios had never made it to the majors. No major league team had ever been hosted in the city's 25,000-seat stadium.
But for me, it was a new start. For me, it was a new opportunity.
After Marco got there, a different type of violence broke out on the streets of Juarez. The Juarez drug cartel started fighting off new rivals who were trying to seize control over their territory. Dead bodies started appearing on the streets.
I mean, there were deaths or there were things happening that I've only seen in movies. It was a crazy place to be in. A crazy time when 6, 7 in the afternoon, you wouldn't see anybody in the streets. You would see everybody after the light came down. People would not hide, but avoid violence or avoid things happening out in the streets. People waking up at 5 in the morning and seeing 3 bodies hanging from a bridge.
Marco and Los Indios tried to focus on soccer, but violence occurred at every turn. Like one day, when the team was on its way to the stadium.
There was a lot of traffic. We drive by a car, a body inside the car with the head decapitated. And things went through my mind. I totally forgot about the game. And I asked myself, what am I doing? Where am I playing? Is it worth going through the risk and living in a city like this?
But arriving on the soccer field was like entering a sanctuary that protected them from all the brutality. On the green pitch, walled off by the stands, there was no drug war, just the beautiful game of soccer. And Marco thrived on the field. He became the team's strongest player, and they actually began to win some games.
We would step on the field before a match, and the sidelines or the stadiums or the crowd would not even reach the 5,000. And most people out in the crowd were our family members or friends. But as we started winning, people started to believe in the Indios. I remember looking at the stands. You couldn't fit a soul. The stands were packed, and people would be standing. No one would sit down. And with the packed stadium, the thing was perfect. The team was at its peak.
Los Indios were winning game after game. There was this kind of hope that was kindled in them and in the city that they could, in fact, win the next championship, which would secure their rise to the majors.
We weren't the best team in the league, but we were a team that wanted it more than anybody else.
And then, at a championship game against a way better team, the unprecedented happened. For the first time ever, Los Indios rose to the major leagues.
So we head back to the city. We couldn't even exit the airport because of the people inside the airport trying to grab us, trying to see us, trying to grab an autograph, a picture. And we drive towards the cathedral, and all the streets packed. I mean, the bus cannot go more than 5 to 10 miles an hour because of the people crowding the streets, people trying to jump on the bus. It was like a light to the city. Everyone thought that it was going to change totally what was happening or the bad things that were happening.
This win proved that good things could be born in Juarez too. If the people had faith in anything, it was in Los Indios. On the streets, the players were treated like rock stars. And so, yes, for both Marco and Juarez, there was hope.
I've had a couple of people hug me and cry it in my arms and say, thank you for all these moments. I would be out in the streets 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 and headed to a movie, and I wouldn't worry anymore. I would be calm. I would know that I was safe. Things were happening, but they were not happening where I was at.
Los Indios were the pride of Juarez, and Marco was the pride of Los Indios. He got a promotion and a brand new house. He met a girl at the gym and fell in love. But this feeling of being invincible, both on and off the field, couldn't last. The fighting between cartels intensified and began to hurt the team. When the second season came around, a couple of months later, Los Indios lost their first game. Then their second, and then their third.
It was hard. The violence did have something to do with our losing streak.
A couple of the team's players were given death threats. They fled the city. When Los Indios tried to recruit new players to fill their spots, no one accepted. Then, armed men gunned down the team's assistant coach at a restaurant. As the drug war closed in around them, even Marco couldn't escape it.
I was headed towards the border. I was preparing to get married. I wanted to ask the person that is not my wife to marry me. I was going to go buy a ring in El Paso. At a red light, a truck crosses, almost hits my car, and with the gun pointing out the windshield. And as soon as I turn around, there's another guy with the mask and my windshield with the gun pointing at me and tells me to get out. He put the gun towards my chest and told me to throw the cell phones inside the vehicle, so I did.
One of the men proceeded to get in Marco's car.
Just took off. There was a cop right in front of us, and I ran towards the cop, and he didn't do much. He was like, it's better just to let him go, and he didn't want to have any problems. I mean, I started shaking, and knowing that I had a gun pointed to my chest kind of frightened me.
Did you ever consider leaving?
When things started getting bad in the city, I sat down and talked with my family and thought about moving out. But then I thought, no, I decided to stay because of the love of the team, because of the love of the people that always showed me love as soon as I stepped into Ciudad Juarez.
But before, when the field was a sanctuary for hope and peace, it was now just part of the urban battlefield. It was becoming too difficult for the team to catch up on all its losses.
We lasted 17 games without scoring a goal in the two seasons. When I would get home and talk to my wife or my parents, and I would be like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what I can do to better this.
Los Indios had one game left to salvage the season.
But as soon as we lose a game, I guess that's when all the pressure, all the pressure came out, and we're just like, oh my God, we couldn't do it anymore. It was all over.
And like that, Los Indios descended back to the minors, back to where they started. And now Marco had a decision to make. He got a phone call from another team, a much better team still in the major leagues, that was hundreds of miles away from Ciudad Juarez. Did he want to join them?
It was a difficult decision for me to make because Indios has always been the team I've always loved, the team that's given me everything, the team that gave me hope. First thing I did was grab my things and head to the airport and drive it to the airport, pass by the stadium and just remember all those great moments or all those good games we had or the stadium always being packed and realize it was time. It was time for me to move on. It was a difficult time for me to move on, but if I wanted something good in my career, I had to go to another place.
Thank you, Marco, for sharing your story. Marco Vidal is still playing professional soccer in hopes that one day Los Indios will make a comeback. We first heard about Marco's story in Robert Andrew Powell's book, This Love Is Not for Cowards. That piece was produced by Snap Judgment's Nancy Lopez. When Snap Judgment returns, we're coming back with the sexiest, sultriest, nastiest subject of all time. That's right, math. When Snap Judgment, the Lost Cause episode continues, stay tuned.
Now, let's move to your next selection, which was number...
Welcome back to The Snap from PRX and NPR, the Lost Cause episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, just because something shouldn't be done doesn't mean we aren't going to do it. Now, like a lot of people, I hated math growing up. Hated it. It was the worst. But Snap Judgment producer Joe Rosenberg spoke to Edward Frenkel, and Edward had the opposite problem.
Edward Frenkel grew up in the 1980s in Russia, just outside of Moscow.
Well, in the former Soviet Union. Now it's called Russia. And it's a small town, industrial town, so it wasn't really center of any kind of intellectual activity. But around the age of 15, I fell in love with math.
unlike other aspects of intellectual life in the Soviet Union, mathematics wasn't controlled by the government or the government's ideology.
And the only way to go farther and explore more was to become a professional mathematician. In Russia at that time, there was only one school where one could pursue pure mathematics, and that was Moscow State University.
To get into Moscow State University, Edward would have to take a series of entrance exams. But at most, they covered freshman-level math. Nothing Edward had to worry about.
And then things take an unexpected turn. The first warning shot came in the form of a letter. And this letter came from a correspondence school. And it says, come talk to us. If you are applying to Moscow University, we'll give you some tips. So I was like, okay, great. So I take a train. I go to this office. And they direct me to this woman. And she says, what's your name? I say, Edward Frankel. She says, are you applying to Moscow University? And I said, yes, I am. And she says, okay, and what's your nationality? And I was a little startled by this. Why is she asking me this? But I say, Russian, because that's what's written in my passport. She smiles, and she says, uh-huh. And what's the nationality of your parents? I say, well, my mom is Russian. She says, and your father? And my father is Jewish. And she goes, aha. And people around me, they all looked at me like I was a terminally ill patient. They kind of look, all averted their eyes. And she says, did you know that you're not going to be accepted to Moscow University? I didn't know that. Why is that? Because they don't accept Jewish students. I said, well, what do you suggest I should do? She said, well, just withdraw your documents. Don't even try, because it's not going to happen. My heart sank. I was aware of anti-Semitism in general, but mathematics seemed to be like such a pure profession that me and my parents, we thought that there would be no problem in terms of my ethnicity. And here I should tell you the story about my father.
Edward's father had wanted to be a physicist, but he was denied entrance to the same university, Moscow State, because his father, Edward's grandfather, had been imprisoned by Stalin.
But there was an interview. There was an interview. And at the interview, he was told that you are the son of the enemy of the people, and therefore we cannot take you. So my father had to go to a technical school, and he was not able to fulfill his dream of becoming a physicist. But at the end of the day, there is no choice. I have to do it. I have to do it. I have to try. And I know things so well. I'm so good. How can they not accept me? That would be absurd. If anything, it made me prepare even harder for the exams, because like I'm going to show them.
So Edward applied anyway, and a few weeks later he took the train back up to Moscow to take the written part of the exam.
And it consisted of 5 problems. And usually, the 5th problem was supposed to be so hard that students were not expected to solve it. But I was just so determined that I was able to solve all 5 problems, including that most difficult 5th. So I was sure it was a пятерка, a 5, which is like an A. So then it was the oral test.
The oral test was a chance for Edward to finally meet his examiners face to face. So he took the train back up to Moscow, where he was put in a room with 20 other students, and everyone was given 2 randomly assigned questions. After he had prepared his answers, all Edward had to do was raise his hand and then explain those answers to one of the test's proctors.
I was ready literally within a minute or two. And so I raised my hand. I raised my hand, but nobody came. It was kind of comical, because here you are in this room, 20, 25 students, and as soon as someone raises their hand, the examiners rush to him or her and start asking the questions. But I'm sitting there, and they look right through me, as if I'm not there, as if I don't exist. And at some point, I literally grabbed one of the examiners because he was passing by. And I said, why are you not taking my exam? And he said, I'm not allowed to. And he quickly walked away. An hour passed by, maybe a little more. By that time, the other students already left and the exam was over. I'm still sitting there. Nobody's coming to me. Then I see 2 men entering the room, and they approach the person who was sitting at the front, and that person points at me. That's how I knew that those were my inquisitors. So these two guys sit at my table, finally. And they say, okay, so what have we got here? And the first question was about a circle inscribed on a triangle. It doesn't matter what the details are. But they immediately ask me, what is the definition of a circle? And I said, a circle is a set of points on a plane equidistant from a given point. And the guy goes, wrong! Kind of cheerfully, like he was so happy that he found a mistake. But what could possibly be the mistake? This is absolutely the correct definition. So he paused, and then he said, it's the set of all points equidistant from a given point. And that's how it proceeded from that point on. What is a line? What is a tangent line? What is a limit? What is a function? What is a ratio? Under what conditions this is well defined? Under what conditions this well defined? What does it mean? But I was like, oh, you want me to answer this question? I will answer it. You want me to ask this question? I will answer it. So I felt like I'm just going to do so well, there will be no other way for them but to give me a good grade. And so these two questions probably took almost 3 hours. And I was getting tired. And it was getting dark, and so abruptly they said, okay, we're done with the questions. Now we're going to give you problems to solve. So they give me this problem, and I realized very quickly that it is beyond the curriculum. But boom, I'm solving it. And he said, oh, are you still working on it? And I'm like, yeah, I'm almost done. He said, okay, well, since you haven't finished yet, let me give you another problem. And the second problem he gave me was twice as hard as the first one. And again, he says, oh, have you solved it? And I said, almost. And again, he goes, let me give you another one. And the last one, the third one he gave me, was a killer. And it was very innocent on the face of it. It kind of didn't sound that complicated. So you cannot say right away from the outset that they are pulling something, they're doing something unfair. But if you try to solve it, you see eventually that it is extremely hard. So finally there is this crushing knockout punch. Boom. That was the last problem. So then he comes back and he says, okay, so let's tally the scores. And then he presents his version of the exam. The first question you didn't answer. Second question, well, you said something, but you didn't really fully answer. You didn't solve your first problem. You didn't solve your second problem. And now you cannot solve the third problem. So what can we do? We would like to give you a passing grade, but we can't, can we? We're going to give you an F. That's the only option we have right now. But I still had this slight hope. So I said, can I see my written test? Because I knew that I solved everything. And when they brought me that written exam, what grade did they give me? It was not a пятерка, not even a 4, which is like a B, but it was тройка. It was a C. They gave me a C for that? It was perfect. I was so proud of myself. After that, it was like, it's over. There is nothing I can do to fight this system. And no matter what I say, they are going to crush me. So the guy says, are you going to appeal? And I said, no, I would like to withdraw my application. A smile crossed their faces. Because, you know, mission accomplished. It took us 4 hours to fail this 16-year-old kid, but man, it's over now. To really withdraw my application, I had to get some documents back. And he says, oh, yeah, I'll take you to the office. Because, you know, by that time, there was no one there. It was already late. And we walked together to the elevator. And I'm just thinking, this guy may have ended my dream of becoming a mathematician because this is my chance. And he killed it. You know, he killed my dream. And the elevator doors close. And it's just the two of us. There's no one else. And he says, wow, you were so great. You know so much about math. I was very impressed. And I'm just standing there, stunned, because he's not playing this game anymore, because nobody's watching. But I'm 16 years old, you know, he's a professor at a university. I mean, what can I say against him? And he says, how come you know math so well? Did you go to a special mathematical school? And I said, no, my hometown, we didn't have any special schools. He says, oh, maybe your parents are mathematicians. No, they're engineers. And he says, wow, that's really impressive. And then he said to me, I'll give you an advice. there is one school in Moscow which takes students like you, meaning Jewish people, called Institute for Oil and Gas Exploration. Apply to that school and they will accept you. And then he leaves me for a minute, he comes back with all my documents, gives me back all my stuff, and he says, good luck to you. And that was it. And I just rode the elevator all the way down to the ground floor. And finally I came out of the building and I was breathing fresh air again. This is summer. And there's this giant staircase, you know, in front of the building. And there was almost no one. And then I saw these two small figures perched in a corner of the staircase. And those were my parents who were waiting for me this whole time. So I'm walking down the staircase to meet with them. And I'm holding this file with all the stuff protruding from it. And of course, my parents realized right away what happened. So I didn't have to say anything. They could tell. That was it. That was the end of it.
Edward ended up going to the oil and gas school that the examiner had recommended. But really, it was just an engineering school, like the one his dad had attended. It had a small applied mathematics program, but very little pure math. Nothing he really wanted to study. And in a cruel twist of fate, it was just down the street from Moscow State University.
And having that world so tantalizingly close, this perfect, pure world of mathematics, and longing for it, and realizing now that I may never be there, was really a crushing feeling. Like, that's it, the door is closed. You have to do something else. You can't be what you want it to be. When something miraculous happened, one of the professors who was teaching at that oil and gas school put me in touch with a great mathematician, Dmitry Fuchs.
Dmitry Fuchs was one of the most famous mathematicians in Russia. But he was also one of a small group of professors who secretly mentored promising Jewish students shut out of academia. Students like Edward.
So it was sort of my first audition. He wanted to see how good I really was. And Fuchs gave me my first problem. And here it's important to understand that it wasn't just some exercise to solve. This was actually a question which no one in the world knew an answer to. And now I was asked to solve it by myself. And that was a very anxious moment for me, I must say. Am I really cut out to be a mathematician? What if I can't do it, you know? Because the thing about mathematics is there is no way of knowing in advance whether you will be able to solve something. So there was no way of knowing that this problem which Fuchs gave me would take 3 months or 3 years or 300 years. And I was working so hard, I couldn't fall asleep. I was so worked up about this whole thing. And so one day, I'm sitting at home at my desk. I also had all these papers clattered in front of me, desperately trying to find this solution. When suddenly, I saw it. I just saw it in a stroke of black magic. It was something that you had to see, kind of like a pattern emerging from the papers out of nowhere. And it was just an incredible moment of realizing that I had in my possession something which no one else in the world had. And my examiners at Moscow University could not possibly take it away from me. It was true just by virtue of it being some objective truth out there. Because I had found my perfect world in which I would be taken for who I am. And so at our next meeting with Fuchs, he says, what do you want to do next? And I said, I want another problem.
Today, Edward is a professor of mathematics at UC Berkeley. To find out more about his journey, we'll have a link to his book, Love and Math, on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Joe Rosenberg with sound design by Renzo Gorio. You've reached the end of the episode, but not the end of this journey. There's so much more Snap, where this came from. Subscribe to the podcast, see pictures, movies, stuff at snapjudgment.org. What? You've got thoughts on the stories you've heard? Join our conversation on Facebook, Snap Judgment. Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and the team that never let bad management
stop them from making good things. Please wave your hands a lot at the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich, Pat Mussini-Miller, Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Lindsay Gorio, Joe Rosenberg, Nancy Lopez, Jasmine Aguilera, and Will Urbina. Now then, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting does not sit upon a secret Fort Knox of gold bullion. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. WBEZ is the place of WBEZ. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could have been with the Uber producer, Mark Ristich, in college when he put on his polo shirt, sported his brand new Docksiders, and attempted to sweet talk Winona Ryder when she ran from her cab into the hotel. And you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. Yeah, Mark, bodyguards hit hard. But this is NPR.